Trump's West Wing today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. A wild week in Washington capped off by a Friday morning presidential tweet storm. This reporter interviewed President Trump in the Oval Office this week.
It's kind of like being in a royal palace several hundred years ago, and you have people kind of coming in and out trying to catch the ear of the king. He likes to be surrounded by his kind of courtiers.
Plus, Harry Truman's decision to use nuclear weapons during World War II was not an easy one to make. The president's grandson remembers Truman being asked a question by a photographer named Joe O'Donnell.
O'Donnell just took a chance and asked my grandfather, "Did you ever have any regrets using those weapons?" And my grandfather said, "Hell yes." He didn't want to have to do that.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Thank you for being here. It's Friday of a week that has made people in Washington and around the world gasp in disbelief. First, President Trump's surprise firing of FBI Director James Comey. Then the speculation, was it about Russia? The competing explanations, plus some great reporting on what went down. And finally, a Trump interview on NBC contradicting pretty much all of the above. So I totally understand if a separate Trump interview yesterday didn't quite register on your radar. It was with The Economist magazine, and in it, Trump claimed to have just invented the phrase, prime the pump. In addition to that remarkable moment, it was the president's thoughts on economic policy that most stood out for David Rennie. He's Washington bureau chief for The Economist and was in the Oval Office for the interview.
We just said, we would love to hear your description of what Trumponomics is. You know, what is your plan for taxes, trade deals? And then we let him talk. And it has to be said that it was not 100% reassuring.
What did he say that made you nervous?
Well, on trade deals, for example, he does seem to share the views of some of his advisors, who we also spoke to for this big piece, that it's almost as if there's a deal between, say, Mexico and America, if the Mexicans seem to be doing well out of the deal at all, that shows you that America has left something on the table, that others are taking advantage of America. And we would take the view that that's just not how trade works. We asked him about that whole saga of how he was on the very point of withdrawing from NAFTA. If you remember, on his 100th day in office, he was going to dramatically withdraw, and then he decided not to. He told us the backstory from his perspective was that he'd been all ready to do it, but then he'd had a nice phone call from the Prime Minister of Canada. He'd had a nice phone call from the President of Mexico, and they'd asked him, could you think again? Maybe we should negotiate. And so he'd agreed to do that. Now, that's actually slightly different from the story that we heard from people in the inner circle, who said it was a lot more chaotic as a process. But in any case, that would have been a gigantic economic decision. And the way that he was describing it seemed very kind of casual.
What did you learn about how Trump's NAFTA about face actually went down?
So we heard some fairly startling stories about how, in fact, the reason that the Canadians and the Mexicans called the president, which they did, was that there were people in the inner circle of Team Trump who called them and said, you need to call him. So there were people inside the White House who were very anxious about what was about to go down. They also called, for example, the new agriculture secretary, Sonny Perdue. He had only just been confirmed at this point, I think like a day or two earlier. And he was called and you need to come over here now. He's about to withdraw from NAFTA. So Sonny Perdue literally asked his staff to draw up a map of the bits of America which had voted for Donald Trump and the bits of America, farm country, which do well out of exporting, you know, grain and corn and things through NAFTA. Showed how those two areas often overlap, went in and said to Donald Trump, actually, Trump America, your voters, they do pretty well out of NAFTA. Mm. And the president said, Oh, then maybe I won't withdraw from NAFTA. Which is
that was it?
That was kind of more or less it. Yeah, that's our understanding, yeah.
If we're to be charitable, isn't it possible Trump is learning on the job?
Yeah, and you can talk to foreign leaders and foreign governments who will say exactly that, that he's actually quite a good listener, that the good news is that when someone like, say, Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel went in and explained to him that Germany doesn't set trade policy, it's set by the European Union, so you have to deal with Europe on these things, that he was like, oh, right, okay. You know, I didn't know that. So the good news is that he's a good listener. The bad news is that often these things, it seems to be the first time he's been told this.
So this was in the Oval Office, this interview. What did the atmosphere there feel like?
The Oval Office, the door was open. There was a lot of noise. There were a lot of people in the room. More people came into the room during the course of the interview. It's kind of like being in a royal palace several hundred years ago, and you have people kind of coming in and out, trying to catch the ear of the king. That's the kind of feel of the Trump Oval Office. I mean, we had a lot of people in there by the end, and he likes to be surrounded by his kind of courtiers.
Your paper described it a little bit like Henry VIII, speaking of courtiers.
Yeah, I mean, there is a kind of Tudor court side to it, and the role of some pretty senior figures, including, you know, cabinet secretaries, was basically kind of to chime in and agree with whatever the president had just said, rather than, you know, offer sort of candid advice or push back on him when he'd said something that might not be factually right.
Speaking of courtiers paying lip service to their king, you witnessed in a little conversation about economics how Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, kind of came to back up Trump pretty quickly.
Yeah, so there was a moment where we were talking about China and currency manipulation, the fact that on the campaign trail, candidate Trump was very ferocious about it, now says that he doesn't want to call China a currency manipulator, in part because they're going to help maybe with North Korea. And he said, and actually, as soon as I started talking about China being a currency manipulator, they cut it out. Now, if you're going to be a fact checker, actually the timing of that is like 2-3 years out of date. China, for the last 2 or 3 years, has actually been spending quite a lot of its own money to prop up the value of its currency. So what was striking was when he made that point, Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, kind of chimed in and said, oh yeah, the day you became president, they changed their behavior. And factually, that just is not right. And it's quite striking to see a cabinet secretary making that point in that way.
Did you get any evidence of the kind of schism between Bannon and Jared Kushner?
So that's a really interesting thing. So a lot of the reporting has said that there's kind of two completely different factions. One, this kind of moderate globalist view led by his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and then the other, this kind of very dark nationalist, angry view. And that somehow those two factions are locked in a fight that one of them might win, and then that somehow will set the policy. Having spent that much time in the West Wing and doing this interview, I would say we came away with a different impression, which is that fundamentally Donald Trump is a nationalist. He's a kind of nationalist with a grievance who thinks that the world has taken advantage of America for too long. It's time for America to be tougher and gruffer and more assertive and more selfish. So if there are different voices, and there are, it's more a question of tactics. It's kind of how do you cut that best deal? Do you bang your fist on the table or do you offer concessions? So I don't think there's a kind of chance that globalist moderate wing is somehow going to win the argument and change Donald Trump. He is who he is.
David Rennie with The Economist, thanks very much.
Thank you.
They don't wait very long in France to go from presidential election to inauguration. Last Sunday, Emmanuel Macron defeated Marine Le Pen at the polls. This Sunday, Macron will be sworn into office. Le Pen's far-right candidacy was a source of anxiety for a lot of immigrants and Muslims in the country. Well, it's been kind of the opposite for religious and ethnic minority groups in France over the past week.
Marine Le Pen, on est désolé. C'est pas aujourd'hui qu'on va décoller.
Marine Le Pen, we're sorry, goes this impromptu little tune. Front National, don't cry. So even a bit of gloating going on there. Rimsara Alouane studies religious freedom at the University of Toulouse in France. So remind us what you had been hearing from Muslims and religious and ethnic minorities in France prior to the vote last weekend.
Everybody was panicking. Everybody was panicking. But at the same time, a lot of people expected Marine Le Pen to be at this stage of the election.
Yeah. Elaborate a bit on that. What was the panic really over? Like, what was Marine Le Pen saying that got a lot of people upset?
Oh, the usual anti-Muslim sentiment card, targeting Muslim as the first threat of the nation. And the most concerning part is that she mainstreamed it. So it became part of the norm. And this worried minorities. So as you can imagine, everybody is now relieved. So yes, it's a relief for minorities for now.
So what do we know about how French Muslims voted in this election and how do they tend to vote in presidential elections in France?
So I will not give you any numbers for one simple reason. Statistics on religious minorities are prohibited. For one simple reason, we do not recognize the concept of minorities in France because there is one people, the French people. So we do not have a number, a precise number on Muslims who voted or for whom they voted. Mm. But many studies show that Muslims tend to vote for the left or for far left parties. And this time they had to choose the person that would guarantee their survival, if I may say it. Macron won their votes precisely because he didn't use this anti-Muslim sentiment rhetoric.
Mm. And anecdotally, have you spoken with Muslims and other minority groups who said, you know, we didn't support Macron, but we voted for him to keep Le Pen out of office?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I know a lot of them. And some of them went to vote with little hope, I must admit, because you still have this attitude that basically no matter who win, things will be the same for us. But people believe in this democracy. People believe in the values of the Republic, and they went to vote to fight for them. And that was one of the reasons people went to vote, even if they did not approve of Macron's ideas and program.
Yeah. Do those same people believe Macron is the person who can kind of keep democracy alive in France?
The opinion is kind of divided. So you have a group that would say all the same. He is part of the establishment. He would just repeat what former presidents did, right? But you also have groups that would say he didn't play the anti-Muslim card. He actually was one of the very few who said that there is no issue with religion in France. Religious freedom should be respected. Laïcité, that's a form of secularism, shall not be used against religious minorities. So they are willing to give him a chance. Some people see him as, you know, the guy who can implement the American dream in France. He's seen as the guy with this American mindset. I don't care of your religion or what you're wearing. I just want you to be part of the fabric of this country and to contribute.
How much was the U.S. presidential election kind of a cautionary tale for French voters?
That's very interesting. I think a Donald Trump style clearly affected Marine Le Pen's campaign. We saw her playing the fake news card and also the style she adopted in her last debate. But I think it was a signal for us to be careful. And we just did not fall into it. You know, Muslim kept wondering, like, if Marine Le Pen is elected, where are we going? Oh, to the U.S., wait, we can't because the American dream is done. So Canada is left, right? You know, we are citizens. We want to stay in our country. So the point was that how to avoid what happened in America. And fortunately, we still remember our history with religious minorities. We still have the burden of World War II upon our shoulders. And we remember what fake news, what targeting religious minorities led to. And I think this affected a lot. So Donald Trump was a signal for France to basically say, be careful, don't do what we're doing.
Rim Sara, for you, is Emmanuel Macron a kind of light switch that means France is now the welcoming place you want it to be?
Emmanuel Macron has not totally won. We still have legislative elections in June. He is still in campaign mode. He needs a majority at the National Assembly to be able to conduct his policies. So it's really a wait and see. So I will wait and I will tell you in the future what I think. But I want to believe, I mean, for now, he showed that he cares, that he really wants to bring some change. But my question is, at what cost? So wait and see.
Rim Sara Alouane studies religious freedom at the University of Toulouse in France. What is the U.S. position on the Paris climate deal? Even the American delegation at a climate meeting this week doesn't know. That story's up next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. A small U.S. government delegation is in Bonn, Germany this week. They're there for meetings on the rules that will govern the Paris Climate Change Agreement. But members of that American delegation don't even know whether Trump will keep the U.S. in that agreement past this month. Talk about awkward. The World's environment reporter Carolyn Beeler has been keeping an eye on the meeting. Carolyn, I've read that the U.S. delegation that's been sent is smaller than the one from Zimbabwe. Is that right?
Kind of. So there were 7 delegates pre-registered around the beginning of May, and that was smaller than the Zimbabwe delegation. There are about twice as many people actually in Bonn. But if you compare that to the 44 U.S. delegates that were sent last year to the same meeting, you can kind of see how U.S. priorities have changed.
Yeah. So the Trump administration this week, while this meeting was going on, actually delayed a decision on whether to pull out of the Paris Agreement. That was a promise he made on the campaign trail. So how is this waiting period now impacting the meetings?
So the delegation obviously has very little, if any, political direction going into these meetings, but they're very technical. They are sort of building the rule book that will guide how the Paris Agreement will work. Those technical meetings are basically going on business as usual. But outside of the walls of the negotiating rooms, it's a different story. I talked to Paul Bodner, who's a former climate advisor to President Obama, and he's in Bonn this week, and this is what he told me.
Well, of course, everyone outside the four walls of the negotiating rooms is wondering what the United States is going to do and whether this delegation that has showed up to this meeting will even be here for the next one.
And Bodner told me they've been working on an international climate change deal for a long time. So they're going to keep trying to build it up from within until they're basically told not to anymore.
The United States is a little bit like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. You know, when we're Dr. Jekyll, we're working with the international community to construct a framework for climate action that can withstand us when we turn into Mr. Hyde.
All right, Carolyn, so when the White House this week delayed its decision on the Paris Agreement, spokesman Sean Spicer said it would give the president more time to meet with his advisors and figure this topic out. So just remind us, why are some of them arguing to stay in the agreement, going against this big Trump campaign promise?
So his advisors are divided into two camps, the completely abandon the agreement camp and the stay in but revise camp. So those pushing for a revision say that the U.S. can remain a party to the agreement, but significantly reduce their commitment to cut carbon. So that could help preserve diplomatic relations with all the countries who are right now lining up to plead with the U.S. to stay in this agreement. And it could also help the U.S. shape the agreement.
Now, we heard earlier on the show from our journalist at The Economist, David Rennie, how Trump's agriculture secretary recently presented the president with a simple map showing areas of the Rust Belt where people would really suffer if he pulled out of NAFTA and he stayed in it. Does it seem like on climate there is something, some evidence that would change Trump's mind and go for a revision instead of a full pullout from the treaty?
So President Trump and his advisors have had a lot of meetings on this topic. So I don't know that there's one data point that would really sway his opinion at this point. But for a former businessman, I would think that the business argument, the economic argument, might be the most persuasive.
So this meeting in Bonn lasts through next week. What should we expect? Any fireworks in the offing?
I don't think there will be any fireworks at this highly technical meeting, but tomorrow, Saturday, the U.S. has to defend its progress toward the goals that it has set. So the U.S. has already answered on paper some questions from the international community about how it's going to cut carbon when many of the big carbon-cutting policies have been reversed or rolled back by President Trump. And in that printed document, the answers said things like the administration is reviewing policies and it's not going to support policies that have an adverse effect on U.S. competitiveness. So if you can imagine these U.S. delegates sitting in a room trying to answer these tough questions with that boilerplate language, you can tell it might get a little bit awkward.
Yeah, I'll bet the other delegates are going to want better answers. Carolyn Beeler on the Environment Beat for us here at The World. Thank you.
You're welcome, Marco.
Pope Francis arrived in Fatima, Portugal today. Tomorrow, he will canonize a brother and sister who reportedly saw a vision of the Virgin Mary there a century ago. Hundreds of thousands of Catholic pilgrims are converging on Fatima for the ceremony. As always, the town will do a brisk trade in souvenirs and in another item that is not for the pilgrims to take home, as Amanda Kersey discovered when she visited Fatima earlier this spring.
The Shrine of Fatima's church is a two-story concrete circle set low in a large public square. On the way there, visitors pass by a plaza of souvenir stands crammed with rosaries, keychains, and toys. The bestseller are Lady of Fatima figurines in classic white with crystal eyes or glow-in-the-dark green with glitter. Then something plainer yet stranger for sale. Beeswax body parts.
We have hands, foot, the leg, the full leg, the heart.
Tokens of devotion, vendor Eduardo Silva says, offered as thanks for a cure or in hopes of one.
Okay, so the people when have a problem, for example, in a hand or something, promise to Our Lady of Fatima that if they were cured, the problem was solved, they come to Fatima to put on the fire one of these to burn there. It's like a promise, yeah.
In other words, wax molded around the objects of answered prayers. a premature baby that pulled through, breast cancer in remission, homes and businesses that survived the crash. Small miracles celebrated in Fatima because of the big one on May 13th, 1917, when three children said they saw the Virgin Mary. Among the things she told them, some, but not all, of the sick would get better if they had faith.
Do you believe in it?
Yes, I believe. If I don't believe, I wasn't here in Fatima selling the products.
Every month, pilgrims from all over the world burn several tons of wax at an outdoor metal fire pit on the square. Most of those aren't lifelike, but instead simple candlesticks sold for pocket change under a tent. Loli Sanchez Galan, from Spain, just bought a few. What she had prayed for, she won't say.
Because if I do, I might even cry. So I'd rather not say.
Galan is on her way to the fire pit. There, people are quietly placing their candles on the grate, which is dripping with melted wax. Among them, American Travis Moon and his family. They're here from Colorado.
I think it's an important symbolism for Catholicism, so we wanted to see what it was all about and learn more about the miracles.
Even under the cold March drizzle, Moon's young son is into it.
My name's Trey.
Hey, Trey. I saw you looking at the fire. What'd you think of the fire?
It's pretty cool that you actually get to burn a candle or something.
Are you going to burn one?
Yeah.
He's about the age of the kids who put Fatima on the map. Two of them, Francisco and Jacinta, are soon to be saints. John Paul II called them two candles which God lit to illuminate mankind. Pope Francis will canonize them on the 100th anniversary of their vision. Good for Catholicism and good for business, says vendor Eduardo Silva.
For now, isn't so good because we don't have yet a statue that says San Francisco and San Jacinta.
I imagine somebody's working on that, making the new figure.
I think so. We believe so. Our suppliers, I think they are thinking about it.
Fatima's souvenir stands aren't acting too soon, though. Vendor said no new figurines until the siblings' sainthood is official. For the world, Amanda Kersey, Fatima, Portugal.
If you've never seen one of these fire pits where people burn candles and wax figures, Amanda posted some great photos at PRI.org.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. Ice cream lovers, listen up. Vanilla prices are skyrocketing, and Patricia Rain knows why.
I'm known pretty much worldwide in the regions where vanilla is grown as the Vanilla Queen. And I often receive emails that begin, "Dear Vanilla Queen."
That's ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. We're at the end of an especially wild week in Washington, where it was seemingly all about President Trump all the time. Like him or not, Trump's the kind of president who attracts constant attention, and that made us want to look back at one of Trump's predecessors in the Oval Office, a more understated leader, that's for sure. Harry S. Truman was perhaps one of the most influential and underrated presidents of the 20th century. He oversaw the end of World War II and rose to the challenge of the Cold War, and he was crucial to the creation of international organizations like the United Nations and NATO that aim to unite countries. But for many people, Truman is remembered for really one thing, his decision to drop nuclear bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan in August of 1945. His grandson, Clifton Truman Daniel, is now an advocate against nuclear weapons, and he joins us from the studios of our friends over at WBEZ in Chicago. So, Clifton, thanks for being with us. Where exactly do you stand on nuclear weapons today?
Well, that seems to beg a simple answer. I'm against them. That's it.
And being against them, how does that make you feel about your grandfather's decision to bomb?
Grandfather, yeah, he made that decision. He always said it. He never changed what he said or wrote about it. He made the decision to shorten the war and save American lives primarily, as well as Japanese lives, had the war gone on, had there been a full-scale invasion. the scholarship on that goes back and forth. But Grandpa, having made the decision, nonetheless felt horrible about the destruction, about the loss of life. There was a White House photographer named Joe O'Donnell who took, as a when he was in the military at the end of the war, took some of the earliest images of Hiroshima and Nagasaki after the bombings. And O'Donnell wound up on the beach on Wake Island with my grandfather. Mm. This is when Grandpa went to meet General MacArthur in 1950. And they were alone on the beach, O'Donnell and my grandfather, and just O'Donnell just took a chance and asked my grandfather, did you ever have any regrets using those weapons? And my grandfather said, hell yes. He didn't want to have to do that.
Talk a bit about when you really started to reflect on all this. Like, how old were you? Do you remember, like, the conversation you had with your grandfather, Harry Truman, where the bombings of these Japanese cities became really real?
No, he never spoke to me about the atomic bombings. I learned about them like everybody else in history class and from my books. And the books didn't tell me much. There's a page or two. There's maybe a picture of the mushroom cloud, a picture of the empty streets of Hiroshima, but it doesn't really tell you about – you get casualty figures, but it doesn't really tell you what happened on the ground. I didn't understand that until I was in my 30s, 40s actually. My son Wesley – Wes is 28 now. He was 10 years old. He was in school here in Chicago in fifth grade, and he came home with a book, Sadako and the Thousand Paper Cranes. It's the fictionalized account of a true story, a little girl named Sadako Sasaki. She was 2 years old when the bomb destroyed Hiroshima, and she and her family escaped pretty much unharmed. They were lucky. But 9 years later, Sadako was diagnosed with radiation-induced leukemia, and in an effort to save her own life, she followed a Japanese tradition that says if you fold 1,000 origami paper cranes, you are granted a wish or long life or health. Sadako folded probably 1,300 cranes. Wow. While she was in the hospital. And unfortunately, it did not help. She died of the leukemia in 1955. There is a statue to her and to all of the children killed, wounded, sickened by the bomb in the Hiroshima Peace Park today. That was the first human story I had ever seen of Hiroshima or Nagasaki. And I remember telling Wesley at the time that it was important that he understand both sides, that it was important to understand his great-grandfather's decision, his country's point of view, but also to understand what that decision cost the people of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I mentioned reading that book to a Japanese journalist sometime after that, and the story was read in Japan, and I had a phone call one day from Masahiro Sasaki, Sadako Sasaki's older brother, himself a survivor of Hiroshima. And he just said, nice to talk to you. Can we get together someday? Would you consider coming to Japan? Mm. And I said yes to all of that.
Had you been
to
Japan before
met
that?
I had never been, yeah. No. We finally met in New York in 2010 at the 9/11 Tribute Center, where Masahiro and his son Yuji were donating one of Sadako's original cranes as a gesture of healing. And at the end of our meeting, Yuji Sasaki took out a small plastic box and dropped a tiny paper crane into my palm and said, that's the last one Sadako folded before she died. Would you come to the ceremonies in Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
Wow.
And I said yes. And my family and I went in 2012 to both ceremonies and sat down and talked to more than 2 dozen survivors.
Yeah, what
was
that like?
So it was really then that I it's hard to explain. It's hard to describe. It's, you know, I want to say it's heart-wrenching. It's hard. It's horrible to hear these stories. But as hard as it is for the listener, it's harder still for the survivor who relives that day over and over and over again solely in an effort to let the listener know what it was like so that we don't do it again.
As the grandson of the president who made that decision, did you feel like any residual guilt meeting these people?
No. Guilt, no. Responsibility, yes. And not responsibility for the bombings, but responsibility to do what I could to help ensure that it doesn't happen again. all the survivors asked me in Hiroshima and Nagasaki were to please help them tell their stories, continue to help them tell the stories. So I've tried to do that.
I know you've become acquainted with a number of descendants of various world leaders, including a member of the Japanese imperial family. How did you meet them? Who are they? And given how your respective ancestors were involved historically, was it difficult to relate to them or maybe easier in some way?
No. And the one you're talking about, not a member of the imperial family, but the great-grandson of wartime Prime Minister Tojo, this Hidetoshi Tojo. And Hidetoshi and I have never met face-to-face. We were both on an Australian public television show called Insight a couple of years ago. They did a two-part show called Bloodlines, the first part being on the European theater of World War II and the second part being on the Pacific theater. And I was in the studio here in Chicago, and Hidetoshi was in Australia. And the show also included the great-grandson of Joseph Stalin and the son of Hans Frank, who was the governor general of occupied Poland during the war, responsible for the deaths of tens of thousands of Jews. And Hidetoshi, when it came time for our interview, listening to him, he was doing sort of the same thing I was. He was trying to reconcile. He was trying to find the middle ground in talking about the war. And afterward, we struck up an email correspondence, and the two of us have been talking to each other on and off for a couple of years.
Tojo was hanged after an international trial after the war, correct?
He was.
Did that come up with Hidetoshi?
Yes. He said two things about that. One, he thought it was proper and honorable for his grandfather to take responsibility for the conduct of the war, but he didn't think that his great-grandfather should have been hanged.
What do you remember of your grandfather, Harry Truman?
The earliest memory was when we were very young. He came to visit us in New York. I grew up in Manhattan. And Grandpa, Gammy and Grandpa would stay down the street at the Carlisle Hotel. And Grandpa got up every morning, went for a one-mile walk at a military pace, 120 steps a minute. Always said that anything more than a mile walk didn't do a man over 40 any good. Mm. So he'd go for a mile walk, come back, eat a quick breakfast, grab as many newspapers as he could get his hands on, and cart them up to our apartment, let himself in with the spare key, and throw the whole mess on the floor and read until somebody woke up.
Wow.
And my brother Will and I were the first ones down one morning, and we saw Grandpa in the living room. He was behind the newspaper, so he didn't see us. And we started to tiptoe past him to get into the den to turn on the television set and watch cartoons. And he caught us. He said, "Where do you think you're going?" And I said, "Into the den to watch Bugs Bunny." He said, "You don't want to do that." And I was probably thinking, "Yes, I do." And he walked between us, and he went into the den. He took a book down from the top shelf, and he came back out, and he said, "You come here and sit down with me." And we didn't argue with him. It was fruitless anyway. So we sat down, and he opened the book and started to read. And my mother came down probably 15 minutes later and stopped cold at the bottom of the steps. We were sitting on either side of Grandpa, stock still, silent, while he read to us from a book that didn't have any pictures in it. And she said, "What are you reading to those kids?" And he showed her the spine of the book. It was Thucydides, History of the Peloponnesian War, at 6 o'clock in the morning to a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old. I took that book down some years later when I was in my late 30s or early 40s. Got a glass of wine, and I sat down in the living room with that book, thought, you know, if he wanted me to read it when I was 4, I should probably try when I was 40. Huh. I got 2 pages into it and shut the book and finished the wine. It was tough stuff.
When he took that walk in Central Park, did he have Secret Service in the shadow? Or
Not until 1965. Early 64, after JFK was assassinated.
Just one last thing I want to ask you, Clifton, if I could.
Yeah.
With the Trump White House, we see this kind of tension between nepotism and legacy. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts about that.
You know, it's a mixed bag for me. My grandfather, when he was a senator, had my grandmother on the payroll, and she was answering mail and doing secretarial stuff, and he caught flack for that.
Hmm.
you know, to bring your kids and your son-in-law in close to the White House as advisors when they've had no experience in government, no experience in world affairs, is a little bizarre. That said, if Ivanka Trump particularly has a calming and rationalizing influence on her father, great. So again, mixed bag. It's legacy is the one thing that struck me a little while ago about President Trump was the whole brouhaha over his comments about Andrew Jackson and the Civil War, which of course Jackson didn't live to see. And it, you know, that he doesn't know the history. My grandfather loved history. He was the last president we had who did not have a college degree, never even went to college. But he read constantly, and almost all of it was history, was biography, autobiography. So the presidency and the country come with them a rich history, and you need to know it to be able to take us forward. Like Grandpa said, there's nothing new in the world but the history you don't know. And so that bothers me that President Trump doesn't seem to be paying attention to the legacy.
Clifton Truman Daniel, the eldest grandchild of President Harry S. Truman, thank you very much for being with us today. Great to speak with
you. You're welcome. Thank you, Marco.
Before we take a short break, here's a quick preview for a couple of stories we'll have for you next week on The World. The first one has to do with a little-known piece of American history, when the U.S. Army imported camels for expeditions across the American Southwest.
They needed a beast of burden that could pack a heavy load, 600-800 pounds, say, and go a long ways without a drink of water.
And along with those camels, the Army needed people who know how to handle the animals, which is how a camel driver named Hajj Ali ended up in America.
When he gets over here, they can't say his name. It's hard to roll off the tongue, Hajji Ali. And so they start calling him Hajj Ali. And the name sticks.
We'll hear the story of those camels and of the camel driver who may have been America's first immigrant from Syria. Also next week, a look at the border where Afghanistan meets Pakistan and the confusion some people have over where that border is exactly. We'll speak with a map maker who explains how the border appears on Google Maps. It begins with border posts pounded into the ground by surveyors in the 1800s.
Today, they can walk that border with a GPS and they can create the digital equivalent of those border posts that they originally marked over 100 years ago.
But even digitized maps may not solve the problem of a border that neither side can agree on.
They're not going to paint a great big red and white line across the mountains and across the rocks all the way along this 1,500-mile border. So people need to understand where they are, and probably both countries need to have more tolerance about people crossing that border than they do at the moment.
More on the Afghan-Pakistani border, plus other great stories from around the globe coming your way next week here on The World. For you ice cream lovers out there, and I'm one of them, I have some bad news, especially if you like vanilla. That cone might cost you a little more this summer. It's because of something that happened on the island nation of Madagascar off the southeastern coast of Africa. Here's The World's Shirin Jafari with the story.
It all started with this. Back in March, a cyclone hit Madagascar.
It was very, very high winds. This was a Category 4 storm.
Joshua Poole saw what happened. He's lived and worked in Madagascar on and off for the past 15 years.
You see trees that are, completely bending in the wind. Roofs of houses, if they're not protected, are flying around. And really intense rain for several days.
81 people died before it was all over. About 6,000 others were displaced. 2 months later, and the survivors are still picking up the pieces. It's especially hard because many have lost their main source of income. Madagascar is the world's largest vanilla bean producer, and the cyclone ripped apart vanilla farms.
If you can picture vanilla as a vine growing up another tree, which acts as a support to it. What happens is, if there are high winds from the passage of the cyclone, the high winds could rip out the support tree, and of course the vine goes with it.
With the wines gone, the global vanilla market is in a spin.
We asked for stickers and you gave us paper.
Sarah's cleaning out the ice cream machine in between batches.
Goss Rancatori is the owner of Toscanini's Ice Cream in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
We use a lot of vanilla extract. We also use vanilla beans. We use different kinds of vanilla.
Rancatori says he uses the stuff in other flavors as well, like coffee and chocolate. It gives them a smoother texture. But a couple of weeks ago, Rancatori noticed something unusual.
We were getting invoices from our suppliers, and suddenly there were these little blips.
A gallon of vanilla extract that used to cost him about $90 last year now cost him $400.
Well, the first thing I thought was maybe they made a mistake.
They hadn't. The cyclone in Madagascar made suppliers jittery about this year's crop. Will there be enough vanilla beans? Will the quality be as good as before? The uncertainty sent the prices through the roof.
Everybody I know who is in the restaurant business is talking about this right now. This sudden surge in the price of a key and common ingredient is something that people talk about.
Some of the vanilla Rancatori uses is imported from Madagascar by this guy.
I am Craig Nielsen, one of the third generation owners of Nielsen Massey Vanillas.
Nielsen Massey is one of the top importers of pure vanilla in the U.S. Nielsen says his company has told customers it won't accept unusually big orders, at least for now. And it's not just because of the storm, but a trend that started a couple of years ago.
Companies such as Nestle and Hershey have been stating that they are going to eliminate artificial ingredients from all their products and go to natural ingredients.
Which is fine, but the producers haven't been able to keep up. High-quality vanilla is hard to produce. It takes 3 to 4 years for the wines to grow. Once they're mature enough, the flowers must be hand-pollinated. And I kid you not, the flowers are open for pollination one day per year. Miss that, and you have no vanilla crop for that year.
So, unfortunately, there's no real quick fix at this point.
Goss Rancatori, the ice cream maker in Cambridge, says he has enough vanilla to get him through the next month. That's it. He says he might take some flavors off the menu or tweak recipes to use less vanilla.
Now we're at our busy season. It's spring and soon will be summer. And suddenly we're dealing with this situation.
But while we fret over the price of our ice cream this summer, another vanilla importer, Patricia Rain, has the farmers in Madagascar on her mind. She says a lot of them are poor. What she wants to see is a base price for vanilla,
so that they could at the least be able to send their children to school, get medical care for their families, have enough food for the families to thrive, and have shoes for the children.
Rain has spent more than 3 decades in the vanilla industry, so she's come to really know the farmers.
I'm known pretty much worldwide in the regions where vanilla is grown as the vanilla queen. And I often receive emails that begin, "Dear Vanilla Queen."
She says she doesn't take the vanilla queen title too seriously. What she does take seriously is the future of crops like vanilla. Take coffee, for example.
How many of us think, gee, this cup of coffee I'm drinking this morning was grown by somebody in the tropics who worked very hard to make sure that I have quality coffee beans? We don't think that way. We just reach for the coffee.
That's unless there are no more coffee beans or vanilla ice creams to cool us on those hot summer days. For The World, Shirin Jafari, Cambridge, Massachusetts.
I first encountered the songs of Mexican singer Natalia Lafourcade back in 2003. She wasn't even 20 when she recorded the single Busca un Problema, or Looking for a Problem.
Busca, busca en tu zapato, o sea, un cigarro que no puedes encontrar.
Lafourcade had this girlish voice that played well with funky beats. Now she's got a new album out called Musa, and her voice still has that waifish sound. But now 33, Lafourcade seems to have grown up fast by singing some of the classics from the Latin American songbook on this album. The album's called Musa, or Muse, because she covers material written by some of the greats she admires, like the song Te Vi Pasar by the late, great Violeta Parra.
Sin quererlo, te he mirado.
estar muy cerca de mí. Aquellos ojos, dos cristales que hace tiempo reflejaron su amor. No se fijaron en mí.
New music there from Mexico's Natalia Lafourcade. Her album Musa is all the rage south of the border. The first single's already racked up more than 15 million views on YouTube. We'll leave you with a Lafourcade original, Soledad y el Mar, Solitude and the Sea. Our theme music is an original composition by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Have yourselves a great weekend.
En el canto de las olas, encontré un rumor de luz. Por un canto de gaviotas, supe que allí estabas tú. Despidiendo últimamente todo lo que sucedió.
PRI, Public Radio International.